Coming up, we got Jonathan Macri from Knicks Film School and CP the Franchise from Knicks Fan TV. And we're talking about the New York Knicks going to their first NBA Finals in 27 years. And plus, we look ahead to the finals. What could the matchup look like against OKC or San Antonio? And of course, they grilled me for not having Jalen Brunson on my All-NBA team. I made a mistake. Forgive me. That's all coming up right now. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. We get a Knicks roundtable today with Jonathan Macri from Knicks Film School and CP, the Franchise from Knicks Fan TV. Thank you guys for joining me. Congrats.
Happy to be here, man.
Trust me, we're very happy to be talking Knicks right now. There's nothing better.
I mean, talking Knicks almost in June at this point. I feel like, at least in my world today, that the ecstasy and the high has run out because all I see this morning is anger at me for not having Jalen Brunson on one of my three All-NBA teams. And I'm shocked I was the only voter who didn't have him on one of the teams. So I'm here to say I'm sorry, Knicks fans, and sorry to you guys. If you guys want to whatever you want to do, I'm here.
I'll say this. I give you credit because obviously the voter results have been public for a few years now. So you knew when you left him off that we'd be able to see that you did not vote Jalen Brunson as one of the 15 best players in the NBA.
I did reveal my vote in April, and no Knicks fan said anything to me then when I posted my whole ballot. Nobody said anything
funny
in April.
How social media works. Yeah. I give you credit for the courage of your convictions. I am curious, though, what was your ultimate deciding factor, if you don't mind me asking.
Well, I mean, look, I think Brunson was on the bubble for that third team spot, in my opinion. Okay. I know he ended up second team. So for me, it was about versus Tyrese Maxey, versus Jalen Johnson, versus Denny Avdija. And I think, and at least at the time, I favored Denny Avdija as a two-way guy, had a big year in Portland, Jalen Johnson, an offensive fulcrum with the Atlanta Hawks, very versatile for that team. And then it was really, for me, a matter of Maxey versus Brunson. Okay. I favored Maxey slightly because I thought Brunson, that he carries a heavier load offensively. Maxey had a great year, but Maxey had a much better defensive regular season. Ultimately, CP, I think this is one of many examples this year with award voting where it's like Brunson obviously should be all NBA, and that's a mistake by me. Jalen Duren never should have received any Most Improved Player of the Year votes. And Joe Mazzulla wasn't the coach of the year, but that's who won it. Joe Mazzulla, Duren made an All-NBA team. I've felt like for a while now, and this year more than any other, that award voting, after we got a tease with voting not happening until after some of the play-in games, it was like, should we just be waiting until like before the finals to vote? Because Brunson should be first or second team All-NBA this year. And Mike Brown should be in a top three for coach of the year with the strings he's pulled with the Knicks this year. And Joe Mazzulla, coach of the year, Jalen Duren, those guys don't tell the story of the year. So that's the way I feel about it when it comes to how award voting should change. But ultimately, obviously, I'm one of 100 who made this error.
No, every year I kind of get that feeling like we should probably wait until the entire season is finished before we just start voting for guys, because then you kind of have those situations where it gets a little bit murky. So I woke up this morning, saw the news, and I said, right on time that we're coming in here to confront you about your decision. But no, listen, I had Brunson behind Cade. I had Brunson behind Cade on that second team all year. Same. I mean, yeah, the numbers were down a little bit, but look, I think the success that he had with his team, you factor in the win shares, the success that they had, yes, it was third in the East, but look, Denny had a great year. Don't get me wrong. And I give you credit because I don't think we give enough credit to two-way play. We really don't, especially when the voting is concerned. So I do understand where you were coming from. And like Macri said, hey, you stood on 10 toes, man. You stood on your take. But I'm still taking Brunson on that second team.
The thing with the award stuff, which I think is tough, is like you guys don't get criteria for this. Like there's no like list of like, well, you should consider X, Y, Z. There's a games played thing and that's it. And like, you know, I was saying the whole year, the Brunson on-offs as far as defense almost counterbalanced what he was doing on offense. So I get it from that perspective. I guess the thing, and this is, goes back to like, what are the criteria for this stuff? When you consider what he means to, whether you want to say the locker room, you know, the franchise as a whole, like they would not be in a position to be a contending team without him there. Like, that's the part that, like, with all due respect to some of those other guys, you know, Jalen Johnson, Denny Avdia, even Tyrese Maxey, they don't mean nearly as much to those franchises as Jalen Brunson means to the Knicks. So I think if I was going to have a bone to pick over the selection, that would probably be where I would focus it.
I think that's the best bone to pick, honestly, because it makes me think about, like, you bringing that up makes me think about 2018, 2019, whatever year it was, James Harden won his first MVP. I remember an NBA GM said to me at the time, he's like, you guys in the media are crazy for thinking Harden's the MVP. And I was like, why is that? And he's like, because he doesn't lead. He's like, you can't be the MVP. LeBron is the MVP. He was making the argument. Yeah. You guys are nuts for voting for Harden over LeBron. It doesn't make any sense. Harden does not have these intangibles, this GM said to me, and the ways that LeBron does, these immeasurables. You can't just look at the production on court. You need to talk about what LeBron versus Harden means when it comes to what the team is, defining the team. And I think that's a good point with Brunson. It is. And that's what those other guys, very clearly, you can talk about points per game, scoring efficiency, defensive on-off, just using the eyeballs, the eye test when it comes to watching defense. You can talk about all that stuff. But there's something about Brunson as the leader of this team that does separate him. That's why the Knicks were a 3 seed despite up and downs this year. That's why they're entering the NBA Finals. It all really does trickle down from Brunson ultimately.
Yeah, absolutely. He raises their ceiling tremendously. I mean, you take a look at that MLK Day game against Dallas. I was there when they got absolutely scrubbed out. It was Brunson that brought him into the locker room, had that, maybe it was a player's only mean, maybe it wasn't, but, you know, had that coming too with these guys to say, hey, we got to get it together. The other night against the, was it Philly or the Hawks, in that huddle again, you know, imploring his guys. Oh, it's game one against the Cavs.
Yep.
In the huddle, imploring his guys, we've got to go. We got to get it going. And so you have to take that into consideration. But that's also why I always felt like in this playoffs, the Knicks were going to be a tough out regardless.
Jonathan, I feel like regular season versus playoffs, you guys had your moments during the year, as anybody did watching the Knicks, where it's like, this team just doesn't have it in the ways that they did in recent years. But it turns out they found it in the postseason. John, what would you say is the biggest difference chemistry-wise or intangibles-wise that you've observed in this postseason compared to the regular season ups and downs?
Yeah, I mean, listen, you're getting right through the coals this morning. You're a national NBA media person, so you don't have any allegiance to the Knicks. I got old takes exposed 24 or 48 hours ago. Because I went on my show after a loss to the Pistons, the first game after the All-Star break, and I said, and I felt it at the time, I cannot wait until they blow up this team in the summer, because I'm sick and tired of watching the inconsistent basketball, the lack of seriousness, and the fact that these guys go out there too often, and talking specifically about the starting five, which, you know, me and CP have been talking about for the last 2 years, don't feel like they're a group of guys that like to go out and play with each other, you know, and play for each other. So the reason I bring that up is to answer your question. The biggest thing to me that has changed is, and I think Carl Anthony Towns may have had this on a t-shirt at some point in the earlier rounds, is the selflessness and the sacrifice and the fact that you have five guys who are going out there and, you know, it's just about what is the right play. And, like, you know, my beloved departed Tom Thibodeau always used to talk about, you know, making the right reads and making the right play. First of all, they're not doing this under Tibbs. Never would have happened. Mm-hmm. We could call a spade a spade. Mm-hmm. And I think Tibbs is a great coach. But two, I think they needed to decide internally, like, look, we have the talent. It's up to us to put all of the other stuff out of the way. Now, we could get into, like, what was that other stuff and how bad did it actually get? You know, I hear things. I'm sure CP heard a lot of stuff. I don't know, but something changed. Something changed. When did it change? Did it change after game three against Atlanta? But something changed, because you cannot watch this team now and then think they're the same team that we watched for 6 months.
What did change, CP?
It's a completely different team, as he said. But the reason why I wasn't out on this team, even when they were going through their roller coaster, and a lot of fans were saying, this isn't it, is because with every contender and even the champions, they all have that fork in the road and during the regular season where it's like, you know, they could break or they can come together and rise up. And every team, we've seen that. Even the contenders, we saw the Heat come out from the play-in into the finals. The Pacers last year turning it around from January and almost beating OKC without Halliburton in game 7.
We're up.
Right. And so, you know, when I pull it back and I looked at this team, I said, look, you had 2 major trades last year. You're practically a brand new team. You still almost got to the finals. You changed the coach, new system. We have to account for the adjustments that the two sides have to make. And when we did our season preview, I said, I want to see this team go through some sort of adversity and rise up through it. And you go to that Carl Anthony Towns soundbite in the beginning of the year. He's like, I have no idea what's going on here. And we're all like, well, hopefully he's joking. But he was dead serious. And then you listen to the soundbite at the end of the Eastern Conference Finals, and he said, we speak the same language now. The coach, the players, they met in the middle, whether it was simplifying things defensively, going to more of the icing on the pick and rolls, getting Carl Anthony Towns more involved offensively. Mm-hmm. You know, Towns going into Brown saying, hey, run it through me. Josh Hart saying, give me the CJ assignment. Those things, they met in the middle. And like Jonathan said, that probably wasn't going to happen under Tibbs, who was more, this is my way of doing things. But Brown was more receptive to the coach's ideas, to the player's ideas. And I think they've been a better team for it.
Seems like that's a portion of it here, is the Mike Brown approach, right? Like with him being more adaptable and more changing. I mean, he's been around. He's coached LeBron. He coached Kobe. He was an assistant under Pop when they won a title in the early 2000s. He had failures, disappointments. He's coached the Light the Beam Kings and seen that team rise and fall. And then he goes to the Knicks, and it's a good team. It's a 3 seed. But then in the postseason, things changed. They put the ball in the Cat's hands.
It's funny you start the Mike Brown discussion with the adaptability and the willingness to change. And that's absolutely true. And yet when I think about Mike Brown this year, I think of a guy who, yes, was adaptable, but was also like someone who stuck to his guns on certain things. And he had a very clear vision. I think it's obvious now. It's funny you mentioned Towns, for Carl Anthony Towns specifically before the season. And that vision, I think he was uncompromising on that vision, both in terms of the role that Cat would have on offense, which we've seen for most of this playoffs, and also defensively. And it's funny, I don't think this has been talked about too much publicly, but obviously we've seen Carl Anthony Towns have the best defensive season, I would argue, of his career, and the playoffs, he's been lights out. But I think Mike Brown demanded of him from day one, I need you to be better defensively than you were last year, certainly, and than you've ever been over the course of his career. And you could find sound bites throughout the year, both from Towns in terms of some of the things he would say, you know, maybe under his breath a little bit. And then when Mike Brown would go out there in a press conference and publicly say things about Towns that Tom Thibodeau would never have said.
What are some things he said for like people national who aren't like Knicks fans hearing all the pressers?
He would say like, let's say there was I'm trying to think of a game against the Kings. I know you remember it, where Carl Anthony Towns did not make it back up the end of the floor. And
I remember this one.
Yes. And there was a whole possession that unfolded and Towns never made it back up. And I think it was after that game where, like, I think maybe Mike Brown was asked about it. He said, like, look, you got to get up the floor. Mm-hmm. Like, you got to get back on defense. And there's no beating around the bush. And there were other similar instances where it's like, look, he's got to not foul. That was a big point of contention throughout the whole season. Like, these offenses, like, you got to stop. Don't complain to the refs. And again, he used Towns' name. So that's, you would have said, that's not the way to reach this particular player and this particular personality. And he was never shied away from doing that. And I give him a lot of credit for that.
I think that's a big part of it, for sure. And I think with Cat as well. But we did see that change in the postseason, right? Like game 3, there's a low. And then suddenly there's a story from The Athletic. Oh, Mike Brown could be on the hot seat. It seemed a little premature to me that how early it came, considering that came, the morning after Cat had his 10 assist, 11 assist game, if I remember correctly.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was the morning after. I think it was 2-2 or something like that. I forget exactly. But regardless, Cat took on this role that sort of resembled more what I expected offensively entering the year with the ball in his hands. How did that change the Knicks offense again, the Atlanta series, and how has that continued on throughout the postseason, CP?
Yeah, running him out of that high post, that pinch post, it's been amazing. I mean, especially in that Atlanta series, they were able to expose him, those back cuts to OG, freeing OG up, so you're getting high efficiency points at the rim, and then moving Brunson off ball a little bit more. The cutting, the passing lanes were opened up. I mean, it's been tremendous to see, and it's really unlocked this Knicks offense.
Does that help Bridges, too? Is that part of the reason why Bridges has turned around?
Absolutely. It's allowed him also to play a little bit faster as well, and so you know, Bridges has taken off after that game three, after the goose egg in game three. So, you know, you got to give a lot of credit to Brown because he's pushed all the right buttons. And it's interesting in that we're sitting there watching game two and he's got that rotation with McBride and Shamit and Alvarado out there. And everybody's like, oh, no, it was Clarkson. And everybody's like, what is going on? There's no backup point guard. It was an absolute mess. But Brown adjusted very quickly in that series. And so just give them a lot of credit, man, from running it through town to tightening up the rotations. He's been great.
And it's interesting you phrased it like, has it helped Bridges? They're able to succeed with the offense this way because Bridges is there, because this is one of his specialties, is the ability to, you know, my colleague Benji Ritholtz just wrote a piece the other day in which, you know, kind of alliteration of his name. It's not the bridge, it's the water under the bridge. Mikal Bridges fills in the gaps like water when he is out on the floor. He flows wherever there's an open spot. He does it intuitively. He does it instantly. And Towns has been finding him consistently, him, OG too, as well. So, like, this is why they got Mikal Bridges, to function as this sort of a player in this sort of offense. But beautiful sick.
Has Bridges improved defensively in your eyes as well? Because everybody's talking about his offense. Has the defense become more like that Phoenix version?
I think so he's been better, but they're also icing pick and rolls more in the playoffs than they, well, actually not more in the playoffs. They made that change, I would say, midway through the year. So you mentioned the MLK Day game. Since, if you could actually include that game, since that game, they finished the rest of the regular season second in defensive rating, I think it was. And that was around when they started to change the defense to make it, and that helped Towns too. So it played more into Bridges' strengths. And they also started moving Bridges off the ball more. Now, obviously he's had to be on the ball a lot in these playoffs. And you know what? He's been, I'll say this about Mikal, he's done everything they've asked of him. Yeah. And he's done it really well.
And that's why I didn't see the need. Though, you know, there were little murmurs and like take him out of the starting lineup after game three. I said his defenses have been on point. He's held the most improved player in check in Alexander Walker. Then he goes out and he takes on the maxi assignment. I thought he did a fantastic job there. And he's helping turn that defense into offense. He's getting the takeaways. He's getting the steals. And they're able to play faster. That's where Mikal Bridges, to me, is at his best, is playing in transition. But, you know, as Macri said, you know, filling in those gaps, I think that's going to be vital when they get to the finals. Like, his shot making, stepping into the mid-range, I think it's going to be a very important piece, whether it's OKC or the Spurs.
And credit quickly to Mike Brown, who was smart enough to give Mikal the Harden assignment predominantly in this playoffs, because what's the only way that James Harden's going to beat you at this stage of his career? Getting to the foul line. Mm-hmm. What does Mikal Bridges not do? He doesn't foul. Mm-hmm. And if you go back and watch the game one comeback against the Cavs, there was Harden ISO'd on Mikal a few times, and Mikal stood his ground and forced Harden some tough shots, missed, so worked out well.
I mean, that's a great call there, going back to that game one. And speaking of that game one, the 44-11 run, Brown pushing the right button, realizing Hart, this isn't a game for him. I'm going to put Shamit in the game, and we're going to go five out. We're going to space the floor. And Kenny Atkinson, for whatever reason, forgot he had four timeouts and didn't want to call any in that game. He wanted to save him for the end, even though he didn't use him. But the fact is that was another example of many in this postseason with Brown just boop, hitting the right button in a game where it turned into a win. Landry Shamit, Mikal Bridges, OG Anunoby, Deuce McBride, Alvarado. It feels to me that, like, when you think of championship teams, right? Championship teams, you need a spark plug guard, Deuce McBride. You need a gritty on-ball defensive guard, Jose Alvarado. You need a spacing wing, Shamit. You need a more defensive-oriented Swiss Army knife, Josh Hart. You need front court flexibility. You get Kat, your spacer, your playmaker. You get Mitchell Robinson, your interior guy. You have an engine, Jalen Brunson. You have your on-ball defenders, Mikal Bridges and OG Anunoby, who also are they're definitely not liabilities offensively. Oh. Up and down this roster, this Knicks team that was up and down during the regular season, during the postseason, they look like a legitimate championship team that I think, regardless of San Antonio or Oklahoma City, I wouldn't fault anybody for picking the Knicks. I don't know what I'm going to determine. We'll find out with who advances in the West. But this team, like, legitimately finally looks like the championship team on paper and on the court that I think you anticipated entering the year when you looked at just the names on the page.
That's why I gave it time. Had to give it time because the pieces were there. When you look at Brunson, you look at Townsend. One of the biggest things with them, as Macri pointed out, with Townsend's defense, you know, that was always a thing coming into the playoffs with those two guys. Can you win with those two guys as liabilities on your defense? You watch the games, they're both playing good defense. Yep. Their rotations are crisp. Towns with the rim protection. Like, you don't find yourself, or at least Brown in particular, he doesn't have to find himself saying, well, I need Mitchell Robinson in here to, you know, solidify the defense a little bit more. You got to get tougher. No, they've been doing more than holding their own. And I think that's a big reason why they are where they are.
Towns has a, in the playoffs, they have a better defensive rating by several points. I looked it up last night with Towns on the floor than with Mitch, which is like, if you would have said that to a Knicks fan a year ago, I'd be like, what?
Yeah.
What?
For crazy? Sure.
Well, I was saying they should trade Cat last summer after that.
Oh, listen, I mean, I talk about saying some things that did not age well. Four games into this year, they had a game against the Bucks, and it was, and Towns was just like, he was so ineffective. And then he starts with the forcing it, and like, and physicality is like completely flustering him. And, you know, after the, you know, throughout the game, people are talking about, you know, oh, well, I thought Brown was supposed to unlock Cat. And I got so frustrated because I'm like, we've been talking about this guy for 10 years about why can't this coach unlock Cat? Why can't that coach unlock Cat? Eventually, it's not about the coach. Eventually, it's about the player. But I don't know what it's been, this synergy with him and Mike Brown, that they have unlocked each other, as Kat said, right? They have elevated each other's game. So it's been beautiful.
It's fascinating with Kat, though, because like he did have his series a few years ago against Denver when he defended Nikola Jokic. Gobert was helping off ball as well in that series to help out. But Kat had a hell of a series against the Nuggets for the Wolves to get their first series win against Denver. This playoff, he's been outstanding defensively after a pretty good regular season defensively as well. I think he might have been an all-NBA snub if we're redoing the vote today. Cap might have been on there if we consider the postseason.
I knew once Cade and Luka became eligible, I knew that was it.
Yes. But like point being is that Cat, he seems to step up defensively in the postseason sometimes. Not last year, but we've seen it before with him doing this. And that, to me, I think has been, I mean, besides Brunson playing a little bit more off ball, besides the flow of the offense, the bridges like water comp that you use is right. Cat elevating his play is part of the reason why the Knicks are here. And it also is going to be the key factor for the Knicks having any shot in the finals as well, regardless of San Antonio with the Wemby matchup, or regardless of Oklahoma City with Hartenstein, who you guys know, you had him in New York, how tough he is and how he's even better now than he was then. Yep. And then Chet Holmgren and Jalen Williams being able to space the floor. Cat, I think, is going to be like probably number one on the list of like, if Cat has a all-time great Cat series, Knicks are going to have a shot to really win this thing.
No Cat, no rings. That's been my saying since the second half of the season. No Cat, no rings. They
put
have
that
to.
On a t-shirt.
I have to. I
that's
have
pretty to. Good, right?
Too good not yeah. to.
No Cat, no rings, but this is the series, this finals, where he's truly going to be tested. His discipline is going to be tested. If it's going up against Wemby, how does he handle the physicality, the mind games of OKC, whether it's Caruso, maybe it's Dort, maybe it's Ihart, Chet. I mean, they have so many guys that can get physical with him, bump him off his spots. How will he handle if they're targeting him with SGA and the fouls are getting called? You know, he's one of those guys, like Mike Brown said, you got to channel that energy, keep it on the court, and not let it take you off your game. And so I think he's going to be a key factor here in the finals for sure.
The thing, they've played San Antonio well this year, and I don't know that San Antonio, I mean, unless they actually use Wemby to guard him, which I would be shocked if they did, I don't think San Antonio has the prototypical Cat defender on the roster. OKC has guarded Cat better than look, they're the best defense in the league, so this is not breaking news. But specifically with Cat, they have taken Cat out of these games, in the games that the Knicks have played the Thunder over the last 2 years since they got Towns. And that, to me, if it is OKC, easily the biggest question of the series is how can Karl Anthony Towns still have an impact? Now, what I will say, the team that I would have put number two on that list before this past series is Cleveland. I thought Cleveland always defended Towns very well, but the difference there is they had to utilize their best defender in Evan Mobley to take Towns out of the game. the Thunder aren't going to need to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, they have like you said, they're like three different guys. So that to me, we'll see if we get that matchup, but that'll be a big question.
Jonathan, what team do you fear more in the West?
Do I fear more?
Yeah.
Oklahoma City.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's not, I don't want to disparage San Antonio, but I think a couple things. One, the youth, which, you know, the finals is a different animal. Number two, the fact that Wemby, he's never gone this deep into a season, and you could argue he's already starting to show signs of wear and tear. And then also, like, I think the Knicks are better equipped to guard the San Antonio attack with their driving guards and hold their ground, like on because it's a little easier to close out when you're not necessarily fearing the 3-point shot as much. The Thunder, give them credit. Are they a great shooting team? No, but they always seem to make enough shots when they have to.
Caruso turns into a 50% shooter in the playoffs.
Same. yeah. Crazy.
Do you also fear the OKC Thunder?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have to, go with the Shea factor with the MVP.
Him too.
Their depth.
He's pretty good.
Jared McCain has turned into a monster in this postseason. Caruso. And like Jonathan said, while they may not be the best 3-point shooting team, their hustle, their tenacity, and getting after the 50-50 balls, getting the offensive rebounds, that almost always turns into a backbreaker three. On top of that, their transition defense is way better. I mean, I think they're sixth in the playoffs right now. Spurs are second in the playoffs. The Knicks have had the advantage of running Philly out of the gym, running Cleveland out of the gym. It may not be the same situation there against a team like the OKC Thunder. And so, Knicks are going to have to also be on guard in terms of the turnovers. That's another way that OKC just runs it up in the possession battle. So it's going to be a much tougher matchup.
I think the Shea factor is interesting. He got asked by Zora Stevenson, the very talented sideline reporter at NBC after game five. She's like, last question was, when do you think you're going to have a good game? Like, or rather it was a phrase says, when are you going to feel like you had a good game? And Shea was like, when I have a good game. And it was really like five straight games. I mean, obviously had 32 points in game five, but it wasn't the most efficient. He hasn't had a Shea type of game in the Spurs Thunder series. He might tonight in game six, we'll see, to close out the Spurs, who knows, or it might wait till game seven. But I do think with SGA, the fact OKC is here, one game on the cusp of the NBA Finals with J-Dub playing 30 something games during the season, barely playing the postseason, AJ Mitchell out right now, is a testament to how great their depth is, but also there's a higher level ceiling for the Thunder to reach if they get J-Dub for full games in the NBA Finals. If they get AJ Mitchell back, like, that team could be even better. So that's, I'm with you guys. I would rather face the Spurs. I want a 3-2 comeback from San Antonio with all their youth over OKC going with a chance to go back to back, in part because I think SGA has a higher level that he can reach, and it'll be a hell of a lot easier for him to get into the paint against the Knicks than it was or is currently against San Antonio.
I'll say this, though, about that possible matchup. And again, not trying to get too far ahead of ourselves because that series still has to end. I think the experience that the Knicks got in terms of both Maxey and Donovan Mitchell trying to bring Jalen Brunson into the action, and they have gotten really good, or he has gotten really good, but as a team too, at hedging and recovering to the point where I think they've gotten a lot better at covering those actions. Now look, trying to do that against Shea is even harder than against either
different
of those
monster
guys.
Different monster.
You know what? Donovan Mitchell, I love Donovan Mitchell. He's a great player. He settles so frequently, and he doesn't, I don't know if, I don't think it's that he doesn't see the pass, but like if you are aggressive with him, he'll relent. And there is no relenting in Shea Gilgeous-Alexander's game. He doesn't know how to relent. So it'll be a different animal. But I also, look, McCall, OG, Josh Hart, Landry Shamet, like, they have guys, Deuce, to throw at him and at least, make it hard.
I think that's fair there. And I think one of you guys mentioned earlier the inexperience of San Antonio's guards. We saw Cason Wallace just like pickpocket Dylan Harper twice
in
game five before he could take the ball up half court. Alex Caruso had one on him inside the arc as well. And it's like, Harper is an outstanding young player. And even then, against some of the best defenders in the world, he's having a harder time. And we'll be right back after this break. One of the things that you guys talked about earlier was Brunson. CP, you said putting in better effort defensively. He's holding up. I think when it comes to, like, I'm always thinking draft right now. People talk about some of the smaller guards. Like, there's this guy, LeBaron Filon out of Alabama, who's 175 pounds. And they say, well, you see Brunson having success in the postseason. Brunson is like 190, 195 and wide and strong and sturdy. There's a big difference between that guy when you talk about small guards than some of the very lean, tinier frames entering the NBA. With Brunson, do you feel like in this postseason, the defensive aspect has been a little bit overlooked in part because of that physicality he can play with?
I think he's been huge. And as Macri said, I was very surprised that neither the Sixers with Maxey or the Cavs with Mitchell, they were not able to get to that Brunson matchup and take advantage there. And I think he's been good. As he said, with his hedge and recovers, he's been very good. He is physical. Most of it is what he lacks in height. Like during the regular season, okay, yeah, you have some mental lapses here and there. But in the postseason, he's been more than dialed in. And I think it's a huge reason why they're here right now.
How are the Knicks keeping him out of those matchups?
I mean, I think a lot of it is Brunson, but also, you know, like Landry Shamet was, I'm thinking about like the comeback in game one against Cleveland, like Shamet fighting around screens to recover back to Mitchell. But also Brunson, you know, it's funny. He's such a smart player and he obviously cares about winning, but off ball, recovering back to his man in a timely fashion has not always been a strength. Back me up on that, CP. Yeah. He's been doing that too. Yeah. Like the effort level has been really off the charts. And then the last part of it I'll say is like when he has gotten the switch, I'm actually thinking back to the first series against the Hawks, which seems like a million years ago now. But there were a lot of possessions where he round up, switched on to Jonathan Kuminga, Jalen Johnson, and he held his ground. You know, and it's like, yeah, sometimes you're going to get him, but he's not going to relent. You know, he is going to give you an effort. And I think that's a big part of it as well. So it's just, you know, it's an effort level. It's a being locked in. And we shouldn't be surprised. And that goes back to what we started talking about. This team knows the opportunity they have in front of them. They know they can win a title. So every one of these guys is as locked in as they could possibly be. And I think that's the biggest factor.
Jonathan, for a long time, I've always said about James Dolan, at least he lets his front offices do what they want to do. And like, he's just hired the wrong people. He finally hired the right person, right?
Well, the last time that's been reported on, at least, that he stepped in was the Melo trade. And that, what are we, is it 2026? Yeah. That was 2011?
Long time ago, yeah.
It was 15 years. That's more than half the time he's owned the team. So to your point, that's exactly right. Leon, man, forget a statue in front of Madison Square Garden. There's going to be statues of Leon Rose in every neighborhood here in New York City if they do this. You look at, you know, I wrote this the other day after they swept the Cavs. He's gotten a lot of criticism at times for, like, the Bridges trade got criticism. The Towns trade, that was a divisive trade when it happened. Even it seems like the no-brainer of no-brainers now, but, like, when they went and got OG Anunoby, I don't know if a lot of fans realize the love affair that Knicks fans had with Emmanuel Quickley, to say nothing of RJ Barrett, who was the face of the franchise at one point in time. So every one of the moves, I mean, the Brunson signing was pilloried by some. Mm-hmm. Every one of these moves, it took gumption. I'll use that word. It took gumption to pull the trigger, and he has been unwavering. And it hasn't been perfect, you know, Obi Toppin draft pick, you know, the re-signings after that first, the We Here season, those didn't age well. Nothing he ever did that was a mistake barricaded them in a way that he could not then get out of. And Evan Fournier signing, flipped Fournier into Bogdanovich, which was then the contract used for Bridges. It's like he always was paying it forward in some way. And credit to him, credit to the front office. Brock Aller is a guy that Knicks fans know very well, and I imagine NBA fans will know his name very well soon when he eventually gets a GM job. Hopefully not anytime soon. but you think about the cap machinations and, like, you know, how they pulled off the Bridges trade, you know, Shamet on the freaking a non-guaranteed contract. Mm-hmm. Like, he didn't miss in the conference finals. It's incredible. It's a testament to Leon Rose. Incredible job.
Yeah, I've always went against the thought of Dolan You know, there's people that, oh, he just wants to put people in the seats. He doesn't care about winning. I've always thought that was nonsense. He's always wanted to win. Did he go about bringing in the best people? No. But has, to your point, has he let them do their job? Yeah, he let Isaiah do his job. He let Mills do his job. Phil was an outright disaster, and the fans were ready to revolt, and he did the right thing by getting back in his bags. So, but now with Leon, he's allowed Leon to do his thing. He's taking a back seat. I don't even think he was on stage when they rose the Eastern Conference Finals trophy.
Wow.
He was in the back. He was just in NBA Cup same way. He's allowing them to have the spotlight, but you have to give Leon a lot of credit. You know, when he first came in, I was wondering, hey, is this another one of those guys who, you know, is a flash on paper but not substance? And he's turned that into this franchise, into a formidable franchise.
Kind of a risky hire, in a sense, hiring someone from the agent world to be running a team. I mean, I think it's been fairly successful with some of the transitions, but Leon Rose better than any of the others. And I think that is, you know, symbolic of his whole era. Like, it's taken a lot of courage with these moves. I mean, trading Randall for Kat is a risk. Brunson, he proved something in Dallas, but not to show he could be the face of a franchise. Some of the decisions on the edges, giving up all those picks from Mikal Bridges, deciding to trade a first round pick for Josh Hart, who had his issues. Could he play playoff basketball when he was in Portland? Everything this era, even firing Tom Thibodeau a year ago after making the Eastern Conference Finals, was a risk. It took guts. And I think, like, right now the topic is around the NBA, like, well, what happens with draft lottery reform? Yeah. If you don't know if you're a bad team, if you don't think you're going to get a top pick, the Knicks drafted RJ Barrett third, who was fine. Not a franchise changer, not at all. The Knicks have built this team through smart trades and smart signings at the top of the roster and around the margins. And I think, to me, like, this has nothing to do with a big market team, has nothing to do with really having money, has to do with being a smart front office to make these moves. I think they serve as an example of how teams are going to have to be run in this new era with a lot of uncertainty around the draft.
Well, go for it.
No, well, I was saying, when you look at those lists as for the top front offices, it's always the OKCs, it's Detroit and San Antonio. And I'm looking like, well, these teams, they've had the luxury of drafting number one picks for the most part. The Rose way has been so unorthodox in the way that they've built this team. Brunson was a second round pick. Yes, Towns was the number one way back in the day, but, you know, OG, bringing in Mikal Bridges, like, all these moves that he's had to make to shuffle the deck to turn this team into a true contender with the help of Brock Aller and the team around him, I think he deserves way more credit.
And, you know, they had, again, like you said, they haven't really built through the draft in the traditional way, but Emmanuel Quickley, Quentin Grimes, Deuce McBride, those are three players taken in the later.
Those are some hits.
Hits. And you need those. And then when you factor in, they managed to re-sign Deuce to one of the two or three best value contracts in the NBA. And then even Muhammad Diawara, who I know I'm not supposed to say that name out loud in case any other NBA GMs are listening to this podcast.
He is really talented.
Yes, he is.
55th pick in the draft? Or what was he?
51st.
Was it 50? No, was he 51?
Yeah. It was in the 50s. 51. It was in the 50s. And he like 6'10", can shoot. He got better over the year as a shooter.
These producers of the show, scrub this.
Cut
this part. No, but so they did all of that, and it was great. But also, you know, patience. Look, I don't know what opportunities there were or were not to trade Julius Randle over the years. I know I was ready to ship him out for a bag of basketballs. Yeah. You know, it didn't even have to be inflated. Julius is an all-time great Nick, but he's a frustrating Nick.
Come on, all-time great.
I had him third on, we did a 25 for 25 last summer because it was 2025. I had him third after Brunson and Melo.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Well, listen, that's
slim pickings.
I think I had
two-time All NBA. Right,
I had Langston Galloway fourth on that list.
Wow!
Shout out Tyson Chandler. No, but he never rushed into any bad trades, even when their guys underperformed or guys, you know, fans maybe wanted them out of town, and he always got value. You know, to flip Julius, who, again, very nice player, two-time All-NBA, but to flip him and DiVincenzo, talk about a great signing on the mid-level for, you know, I mean, say what you want about Towns. He's one of the 10 most offensively talented players in the league.
Yeah.
And he's now the centerpiece of everything they're doing on both ends, frankly. So it's a great job.
You mentioned that list, Randall being third or whatever it was, and it's just slim pickings, right? Mm-hmm. You guys were fans of the Knicks since you were kids. What are your fondest memories from that 99 team, CP?
Just the storylines against the rivals, you know, beating the Heat, the carbon copy of the Knicks, the Houston shot, you know, Riley Van Gundy, like those storylines is what, like, deep entrenched me like into this team, you know. Then the Pacers, the LJ shot, beating the Pacers. And again, when I talk about adversity at the top of this podcast, that team went through so much. They traded John Starks for Sprewell. Sprewell struggled in the beginning. They traded Oakley for Marcus Camby. Jeff Van Gundy was about to get fired. I mean, yeah. So much happened with that team, and they brought it together at the right time and had a Cinderella run.
Yeah, I had Jeff Van Gundy on the Knicks Film School podcast a few years ago, and we talked about 99, and he was just very open about what an utter disaster that season was up until the last week. Literally was the last. You know what? This season was a disaster, but not terribly dissimilar to this season with the Knicks, because they started to pull it together late in the regular season. And then it just came together in that last week. And I remember, you know, whatever I was, 16 at the time, going into that Heat series, the 1-8 matchup. And I said, if they get past the Heat, they're going to go to the finals. Because I didn't fear, it would have been the Hawks, or Hawks. I forget. It was the Hawks, but yeah. I forget who the Hawks beat that year in their first round. But I knew we were beating either mm-hmm. of those teams. And then I said, we've beaten the Pacers. Like, we could beat the Pacers, this Pacer team. And they did. And that's why, for me, the Allen Houston shot is always going to be just, I don't know. It might still be my number one shot in Knicks history.
For me, it is.
It's up there. Yeah.
It's got a chance to be surpassed pretty soon, right?
I mean, it might have already. I mean, look at game. Again, I keep going back to game one, but like how do you feel about game one versus Cleveland? Do you feel like that was inevitably they were going to win that series?
This year?
This year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because I'm...
You mean win the game or win the entire...
No, win the... If they lost game one against Cleveland, I don't know if you feel differently. Yeah. I'm like, if they lost that game, I would have been very trepidatious about whether they were going to win the series.
Isn't the series still ongoing?
Yeah, it's Getty. But I bring that up to say, like, the Shamit, the bounce in, you know, reminiscent of the Halliburton shot. You know, like, that has a chance. The Mikal Bridges... Dribble around and then prayer over Evan Mobley fading away from behind the arc.
That was an awesome insane
shot.
Both of those shots have a chance to go down. Like, so this is, it's crazy times.
I said game one was a must win for them. I was on another pod and the guy was asking me, who's it more important for, the Cavs or the Knicks? I said, the Knicks have to win game one. Especially when you think about the Halliburton shot the year before that, that would have brought all the vibes down, all the goodwill that was generated from the Philly sweep and all that. You lose game one in that way by 22 points or whatever it was, all the vibes would have been out the window.
And then the way in which they just won it, too. I mean, trailing by so much with 7:30 left or whatever it was in the fourth quarter at a 44-11 run. That's where it just felt like in the middle of game one as the comeback was happening. This series is over. You know, they hadn't even won the game yet. And the Sam Merrill shot almost went down. Still felt like the Knicks are going to win this series.
I have to give credit to the Knicks, because you bring up last year the Halliburton shot in game one. When this game went to overtime, that series was over.
It was over.
I agree.
You could tell in Cleveland's body language.
It was over.
I agree.
In game one last year against the Pacers, not to talk about old news, the Knicks had a lead in that overtime. Mm-hmm. They kept fighting, and there was a goaltending call that was not called, that should have been called, with Jalen Brunson. Mm-hmm. Miles Turner got it. That if they make that call, I think the Knicks could have won that game, and maybe the series is different. This team has a lot of fight, which is why I'm more encouraged than anything heading into the finals.
Now, with that 99 team, going against the Spurs, there was a sense of not much of a chance entering that finals?
Yeah, I didn't think so. I was more hopeful than anything, but I didn't think they had a chance.
Because Ewing was obviously past his prime, but you needed him for that series. And he had gone down after game two against Indiana in the conference finals. And I just knew, I mean, they were starting Chris Dudley.
Yeah.
You know?
LJ had a bad knee injury too.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah. They didn't have the horses, and it's a shame because that team had such fight, but they just, a Spurs team was loaded.
Now, I feel like Boston, New York are always a rivalry, but for me, growing up a fan of Boston sports teams, I became very spoiled born in 1990, but I grew up hearing stories about the Celtics haven't won anything since the 80s, Red Sox 86 yeah. years, you know, Bruins haven't won in a long time, Patriots were the Patsies growing up, right? Like, that's what they were. And then the winning started. And so I grew up with people, with my dad, with uncles and friends and their dads, where it was like, oh my God, the teams are actually winning again after years of losing. Yeah. And Knicks fans can certainly relate to that, considering it's been multiple decades of barely any winning, so much so that Julius Randle is the third best of this last 25 years.
But it speaks to what the last 5 years, 6 years, if you want to go back to the We Here season, has meant. And, you know, it's funny, and I know CP hears from just as many people on Knicks Fan TV as I do at Knicks Film School. There is a love for the 90s and an appreciation for the 90s. But also, the 90s, for as wonderful as it was, and like that team had a toughness and a grittiness, ultimately, it was a disappointment because the Ewing draft pick was supposed to be the return of a championship.
Yeah. Frozen envelope.
Yeah, frozen.
You know, and that is through no fault of Patrick. I want to make very clear about this. That is not Patrick Ewing's fault. They did not ever give him a second All-NBA level player until it was too late, you know, with Sprewell. But no, I mean, it's 53 years.
Yeah.
You know?
Since the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's insane. Right?
Yeah.
I'm sure like there's people in your life and people like friends of yours that haven't experienced it ever in their whole lives, or they were very young, just a baby when it last happened in the 70s. And yet here we are with another opportunity. Yeah. I just think there's a beauty in that in some way. It's obviously like you'd rather have won 8 times in the last 25 years, right? You'd rather have had that success. However, I think part of the satisfaction that like you can see with Knicks fans right now, you two included, is that from years of misery and then like some challenges as the team has started winning the last 5 years or so, now it's led to finally breaking through. There is a reward in the suffering sometimes. And I think that's one of the beautiful things for me growing up, a Boston sports fan, seeing like that and people who are older than me, seeing how much joy it brought them and how like they never took it for granted. But also I think that's now what Knicks fans can experience with what's happening right now. It's like, wow, it's actually happening. It's actually happening.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's great just really following this team's, from our journey in building our podcast and just all the moves that they've made. And now you get to this point where it's like you're hearing the stories and the generational Knicks fans and, you know, some people who unfortunately they lost their parent or their grandparent and they're sharing those stories. Like, you know, that my grandfather, you know, we used to talk about the Knicks. We used to talk about this place. So it's a beautiful story. And yeah, they haven't won. They didn't win in the 90s, but that's what makes this team so special, because it's like the other day, game four, we're in Cleveland and we're there with Kurt Thomas. And, you know, there's a lot of knock on the Knicks bring back these alumni guys. And, well, they never won. But what I said was like, these people never understand what these guys mean to us, because
a Ewing photo of him.
A Ewing photo.
Oh, my God. It's like, so beautiful.
No, they never won. But for a lot of those guys that we still hold near and dear, they brought their work ethic. They brought their lunch pail. They left it all on the line. Ewing with the ice packs on his knees. Like, he left it all on the line for us. And that's why those guys are still special to us to this day.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm happy you brought up, our shared journey. Like, I think in some ways we owe our careers to the fact that the Knicks were bad for so long. Because part of the reason that we both started doing this, I think, is because there was such a void of, like, the coverage was... There wasn't a lot of coverage.
Yeah.
And the coverage that was there was very negative. And I remember, I'm like, man, someone should say something about the decent things that are happening here. And so I remember, like, the early podcast days of Knicks Film School, I'm sitting there talking about, man, that Frank Ntilikina kid, he hedged on that pick and roll. He had a dig there in the second quarter where he got his arm in there in the passing lane. And yeah, man, that guy's
ISO
gonna be
Zoe.
Yeah.
Lonzo Trivet. Like,
wow. Kadeem Allen.
Kadeem Allen.
Wow, Kadeem Allen. I haven't heard that name in years now. Wow, Kadeem Allen.
There was a Kadeem Allen on the side. I think he was. My yeah, God. He was on like a 10-day and came in and he's like, oh my God, this is the best point guard we've had since. Since Charlie Ward or whatever, but I think that speaks to why Knicks fans are obviously very excited right now, and you know, when you have been through the trials and the tribulations, you know, you do build up a currency And so we're both very fortunate to have been around for this whole rise. But I hope they can finish the job.
And we'll be right back after this break. What year did you guys each launch Knicks Fan TV?
In 2017, covered the Frank draft.
Okay. Wow. Frank Ntilikina.
Yeah.
I did my first podcast for Knicks Film School in the, was it the 2018-19 season, but I was doing post-game videos around the trade deadline 2018. I remember my first one. Do you remember your first post-game?
Yes. I don't remember the game, but I remember the first one, and it was horrible.
I remember mine was, so it was the year KP went down, so that was 17-18.
Yeah.
It was the first game after the All-Star break, they beat the Magic. And Tim Hardaway Jr. had a nice game. And I think they won two games the rest of the year. But that's what I started doing, like the little videos. And it's, what is it, 2026.
So 26. Wow. Yeah. I remember when we did the lottery party at Slattery's Midtown Pub. And this was the Zion year. So this was, we're going to get Katie and Kyrie, which guaranteed the number one pick. You know, ESPN comes in, another media company comes in, they're covering us. And, Mark Tatum, he's running through the list, and you know the fourth pick gets announced. So when we realize we cracked the top three, the bar explodes. Everybody's going crazy. Like we're getting close. We're gonna get Zion. And then with the third pick, the New York Knicks. And then we were just like, oh my god. We're cursed again.
Are we 100% sure that the Knicks didn't get the best player?
That's right.
Not the best player, but like.
Yeah.
Listen, of the top three.
RJ became my guy.
Of the top three, yes. Of the top three, given where everybody's career is going.
I think also that serves as a good example where sometimes in life and in sports, so just but also in life, sometimes what you think is worst for you ends up being best for you. Because what if the Knicks win the lottery that year and they get Zion and you're now on year seven or whatever of Zion like he is in New Orleans and you're just still a middling team trying to make it work with Zion Williamson, hoping he can stay healthy, hoping you can make it work. Like, you're disappointed to get RJ Barrett, but it sets you on this path to where you are today that you never could have anticipated in that moment, right?
2019. What if I don't know what KD was ever really going to do or wasn't going to do, but like, talk about alternative histories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how many teams has Durant been on since then?
Funny.
Nets.
Funny how that works, man.
Suns, Rockets. We're at three now. Yeah. Right? Am I missing any?
I don't know if we're done yet either.
right.
No, I'm not sure we're done.
Yeah, you never know. Yeah.
I'm not sure we're done. It is true, though. I mean, like, there's disappointment that they chose the Nets. They chose Brooklyn over us.
It's that night. That day, I was so pissed.
For me personally, darkest day for me as a Knicks fan.
Yeah.
Really?
I felt like it was the LeBron decision all over again.
Wow.
I felt like it was the decision all
over. The worst.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who the hell wouldn't want to go to South Beach?
Yeah. Yeah, the Nets.
Come on.
It was brutal, man.
Well, tell me this, since we brought up the Nets. One of my friends, my friend Jim Cunningham, used to work with him at the Ringer. He's a New Yorker. He's a Knicks fan. And he said to me and one of my buddies, Wes, the other day in a text thread, he's like, the thing that people don't get about New York is in New York, there's the Giants and the Jets, there's the Yankees and the Mets, but there's just the Knicks. Even though the Brooklyn Nets exist, there's just the Knicks. Everybody's a Knicks fan in New York. Is that accurate to say? Is that a fair portrayal?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, shout out to Evan Roberts.
Shout out to Evan Roberts, who's still a Knicks season ticket holder, but, you know, a diehard Nets fan.
Look, I up until I was able to do this full time, I was a New York City public school teacher for a decade in a school that was essentially down the block from Barclays, in the shadow of the arena where the Nets play. Ain't no kids that were Nets fans in Brooklyn. Like, you didn't see, you know, even when they got Kyrie and KD, like, you might see a jersey here or there, but there was no overwhelming level of excitement. You know, that just never, that team has never caught on. I honestly think they had a bigger foothold in Jersey.
Yeah.
Because at least was a real fan base.
Yeah. Yeah. Big
time. You know, that went back to, you can go back to Dr. J.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
Weren't there?
We almost forget they had Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce. Remember that?
Oh my goodness, Ron Williams.
Separate team.
I know. Yeah.
Gerald Wallace.
Yeah.
Oh, Gerald Wallace. Boy, I mean, it wasn't there like a rumor recently about New Jersey wanting the Nets back?
Yeah. I said, how do we fast track that? Let's get him back.
I feel like it would probably be for the best. I'd imagine, but how do you move? Well, you're already moved away, right?
Right.
It's a beautiful arena.
It is. It's a great arena. I love the arena.
You know? But no, I just think if it didn't happen with... Now, look, who knows? Maybe they draft the next Nets legend or the first Nets legend.
it's nothing like it when the Knicks are cooking in the playoffs. Yeah. Everywhere you go, everybody, the Knicks, you know, they see you with your Knicks stuff on. They want to talk about the game or now the stories about the ticket prices. But there's nothing like it, man. New Yorkers are actually nice to each other when the Knicks are putting there, when the Knicks are going. It's a beautiful day outside, man.
I mean, I've been to Knicks games, never in the playoffs. And like, I think there's certain reasons I've been to. I always tell this story. It was a 2016-17 season, James Harden and Houston. And this is actually against the Knicks, I believe. I'm pretty sure it was against the Knicks, if I remember correctly. He had like 48 points, 18 assists.
Oh, I remember the game.
Well, it was New Year's Eve. Do you remember that one? And I think it was New Year's Eve or close to New Year's Eve. And he had this monster game. And the crowd just felt dead to me. Like it was like the first time in NBA history a guy put up the stat line that Harden had. And it was just like, oh, my God, what are we watching right now? And the crowd was dead. And like for me growing up in Boston, going to games when the team sucked and when the team was good, the crowd was always still loud and excited. I was like, this is kind of disappointing. If I were a young Houston fan and I'm coming here and watching this brilliant player not get much of a reaction for the crazy stuff he's doing on the court. When the Knicks were bad, and I went to a Knicks game the first time, there's an energy there. When I went to Chicago and saw a Bulls game, there's an energy in the arena. There's an energy in the concourse. You can feel it there. Like when I went to Dallas when the Mavs were like, okay, I felt the same way with that arena and like definitely in the postseason with the Mavericks. I can't wait to see what Madison Square Garden is like with the Knicks in the NBA Finals. I was supposed to go to game 5 last night, but there was no game 5 because the Knicks sweeped. But I can't wait for game 3. I just can't wait to see what this arena is like when it was already one of the better vibes when the team was bad. I just can't wait. I'm excited.
You asked about Leon Rose before. His first game as GM, I'm reminded of this because you just brought up the Rockets. They played Houston. And that night, RJ Barrett had probably the best game of his career. Mm-hmm. And they won a close game. And I'll never forget. I was watching on TV that night. I wasn't in the arena. But you could the reaction from the crowd and the feeling like – and they sucked. They were terrible. But it was like they sensed – something.
Yes.
Something was happening. And you just go over the years and all the times where they had New Yorkers have had no reason to cheer, but they did anyway. So what is it going to be like next week? Or I guess in a week and a half now, because we got so much time. It's going to be pretty special.
It's going to be amazing.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it, man.
I mentioned last night, I came in to New York last night. My car drove me in and I got here. I was originally planning on getting here a little early for game 5. Didn't happen. So I was like, I got a little time to waste. I'm going to go to the movies. And I went into Regal and I said, the AMC was sold out. No offense to Regal Cinemas. I like AMC. And I forgot New York City. Every night's busy, right?
Yes.
So anyway, Wednesday night, I see Obsession. And boy, oh boy, is that movie fun. Have either of you seen it?
I have not.
You have not, Jonathan?
We talked a little beforehand. I did see it. The movie I have thought about the most that I've seen this year.
It is
exceptional.
It is a very fun movie. I think it is not scary in the sense that jump scares. It's more just like, this is so freaky and so weird. You're feeling shivers. I never feel shivers with movies. I felt like goosebumps watching that.
Very different from any horror movie I think I've ever seen. You should see it.
I got to check it out.
You definitely got to see it. You got some off nights coming up. You got time.
It's true. Yeah, we do. We do have until at least or until Wednesday. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. We're pumping out all kinds of content between now and then. But yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to say too much because I don't like to spoil the movies. People like are listening to this. I'm seeing it tonight. I don't want to get spoiled, but like definitely go see Obsession, especially if you can see it with like a good size theater. I love a full theater and everybody laughing and oohing and ahhing during the show. But yeah.
Obsession. Good word to describe Knicks fans' relationship with this basketball team. Yes. We are obsessed.
Yes. And also with people who don't put Jalen Brunson on one of their three all.
You keep breaking up.
I mean, good. That's okay. I deserve the heat. I deserve the heat. Guys, are you guys going to OKC or San Antonio?
Planning. Yeah.
He travels. I'm a homebody. I got my two girls at home, and when I'm gone, just the whole place just goes to hell.
How old are the girls?
I'm kidding. So they're 5 and 9. I know. Shout out to my wife. Speaking of like what we do, like the support system that like I have, and I know this is true of CP as well. Like you can't dedicate your life to a basketball team unless you have that. So no, I don't know where I'd be without my wife. But no, I hate leaving them. So it's a good situation because I have my whole setup there. We do live watch alongs on the Knicks Film School YouTube channel, like they do also on Knicks Fan TV. And yeah, but I'm staying here for all the games.
You had a great video after one of the games. You're like, sorry to my wife and kids.
that was during overtime game one against the Cavs when Shamit hit a three to put them up 9, which people might hear and like, why that shot? It was because I refused, because I've been hurt too many times, to believe that that comeback was possible until that shot went down. And then once they went up by 9 with like
you lost
2 minutes
it.
To go, I just couldn't keep it in anymore. Yeah. And because I that was a lot of years worth of
trauma.
I know. I'll be looking for your post game selfie videos coming out of OKC or San Antonio, wherever it's going to be.
Pandemonium, man.
Bring the vibes.
Pandemonium. Absolutely. Yeah.
Bring them, CP. Yeah. Guys, you guys both do amazing work. I think you set the tone for how local coverage can be and also just building your own thing. Really admire the both of you, Jonathan and CP. Thank you so much for joining me.
Appreciate it, man.
Appreciate you, man.
Big thank you again to Jonathan and CP for joining me on today's episode. Thank you to Sarah and Andrew and the whole Yahoo team here in New York City for producing today's show. I'll be back on Thursday night with a post-game reaction to Game 6 of the 2026 Western Conference Finals between the Spurs and the Thunder. Also have an interview with Nate Ament, potential top 10 pick in the 2026 draft. That's all coming up tomorrow. That's all for today, though. Have a good rest of your day, everybody.